Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Mikhailo Minakov, Georgi Kasyanov, and Matt Rajansky about the edited volume From the Ukraine to Ukraine, A Contemporary History, 1991-2021. The volume was published in 2021 by Ibidem Verlag Stuttgart. Let me introduce my guests. Georgi Kasyanov is head of the Contemporary History and Politics Department at the Institute of the History of Ukraine, National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. His main areas of expertise are the history of Ukraine in the 19th to 21st centuries, the history of ideas and political theories, memory studies, and education policy. He's the author, co-author, editor, and co-editor of more than two dozen books on these topics in Ukraine and abroad. Mikhailo Minakov, senior advisor at the Cannon Institute of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, is a philosopher and social scholar working in the areas of political philosophy, political theory, and the history of modernity. Mikhailo Minakov is also author and co-author of 10 books and numerous articles on philosophy, political analysis, and policy studies. Matt Rajansky is director of the Cannon Institute of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. He is an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. He's also an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins, and he serves as U.S. Executive Secretary for the Dartmouth Conference. Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello.
Well, first of all, congratulations on this volume that covers the first three decades of independent Ukraine. So the title of the book also reflects the change, which can be described in political terms as well as in geographical linguistic terms, in cultural and memory studies terms, from the Ukraine to Ukraine. There are a lot of aspects to consider when presenting a history of the country during a certain period of time. What was the main narrative trajectory for your volume? Your volume starts with the introduction and chapters that detail the political development of Ukraine right after the fall of the USSR. And then it gradually moves towards the discussion of identity politics and future prospects of Ukraine's development. Specifically, the last chapter focuses on democracy in Ukraine.
Well, if I may, the idea was to look at Ukraine not only through politics, because this political niveau was very well known in contemporary media. So what we wanted is to tell the story about Ukraine from different perspectives. So these perspectives could have been either sectoral, so politics, society, identity, contemporary culture, religion, democracy, you name it. But also we wanted to present perspective, the fusion of several perspectives, and in the first place, the fusion of American and Ukrainian, or Western and European perspectives on Ukraine. So this is why we have at least two authors coming together, one from the West, one from Ukraine, who had to find common language. So this linguistic issue and the idea of dialogue was primary. So in a way, Cannon Institute is running this Ukrainian program as support to the US-Ukraine dialogue. And here our authors had to find this dialogue and result with the sections dedicated to sector.
Mm-hmm. Matt, Georgi, would you like to add anything to this?
Sure, I'd be happy to jump in, Natalia. I would absolutely echo what Misha said, that you know the way that this volume was constructed is exactly a reflection of not only these 30 years, but one could even say, you know, at this point, almost five decades, because it goes back to the Soviet era even, of the Cannon Institute working to connect scholars living in Ukraine with scholars on Ukraine from outside, especially the United States, but not exclusively the United States. And so, you know, that's a very unique aspect of this volume, that you have a kind of dialogue of scholars attempting to come up with a narrative, but I think not always succeeding. We saw that in the editing process, and I think you even see some of it coming through in the final result, to kind of narrow down to a single narrative. That wasn't necessarily the objective. And then the second, you know, I would leave it to Georgi to speak more to kind of the enterprise of contemporary history. I mean, it's a very distinct kind of scholarly undertaking. But in this particular book, I feel that we have intentionally created a dialogue of narratives rather than a single narrative with multiple speakers. And if you think about the way that other histories are told, and you know, I'm a student of history going back a quarter century, and I remember being kind of given these historical textbooks and then being given kind of alternative histories, right? And what you very often end up with is kind of an official authoritative narrative, which is, you know, very unidimensional, right? Usually it's political, you know, it's the history of a political system or the history of borders or something like that. And then you get these commentaries after the fact, and you're supposed to kind of take the commentaries and you're somehow, as a student of history, you're supposed to kind of figure out how do they apply to the official history which you received in your first days as a student. So what we're trying to do instead is offer both at the same time, right? This idea of narratives or histories in dialogue with one another all the way through, so that you come out of it understanding that each and every question in the contemporary history has a kind of richness to it and a multidimensionality. And that's why, if you even take, you know, Misha's and my chapter at the end of the book on democracy, which, you know, I'm comfortable that we ended the book with a chapter on democracy, that it is in itself not a conclusive statement on Ukrainian democracy. But that's not the only chapter that addresses questions of democracy, right? Those are woven throughout all of the other chapters. This is what I mean by kind of narratives and dialogue. Misha's and my writing is not the last word on democracy in Ukraine.
Yeah, just it's really not conclusive, taking into account the developments in the last 30 years. So it's probably opening. This chapter would be opening for the next volume or for the next tries, next efforts. I would also add that at the beginning, when we started this enterprise, the idea was to present some kind of purely academic volume written for academics. In the course of implementation, it turns to us that we should slightly adjust it to a broader audience. And in fact, now we believe that it will be at least interesting introductory reading for students, for university students, and for broader audience. Another important aspect of this book is that for us ourselves, it was a kind of try to rethink, reconsider, revisit 30 years of Ukrainian independence, and to present a kind of not so much linear narrative, but something which would include events, facts from the last 30 years. In this case, I think this book would be one of the early birds in in the area of other undertakings which would commence or already happening somewhere else. So I hope that I think that it's already published, Misha. Yes, is it correct that it's already in print? So I didn't receive yet the copy, but it's starting circulating. We expect reviews, and I'm sure that reviews would be very different, particularly because of the philosophy of this volume, that we included people, scholars, not just for different countries, and as Matt mentioned, also with different approaches, methodological approaches, different political views, different outlooks. So, it should be something kind of challenging reading for many people. And I think that as many people we have in this volume, with as many views we have in this volume, as many different reactions we would expect on it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, as you noted, the book specifically covers 30 years. However, there are references to the past, and even the title itself triggers this some memory of the past and it triggers how Ukraine was perceived before it gained its independence. So I would like you to share your ideas on how the perception of Ukraine changed over the last 30 years.
Well, to a certain extent, it reflected in the title of the book. At the beginning of 90s, that was a widely accepted practice to write the Ukraine, and then it's just this "the" disappeared, probably due to certain effort or due to natural reasons. But in any case, Ukraine now presented in this book, for instance, as a as an actor, as a sovereign actor of history. So, and that was one of the ideas of this book, just underlying ideas. So this is probably the most important change in perception, that Ukraine now considered by the world as a sovereign actor. Well, you know that sovereignty is a certain extent is a relative concept, but generally you understand that Ukraine is not the Ukraine now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mykhailo,
if I could jump in on that, and then we'll save the final word for Misha. I just would say, you know, look, my view of the title was always that it is meant to be a little bit cheeky and a little bit provocative. I mean, there's nothing particularly profound about, you know, removing or adding the article. I know that people can get into kind of endless loops of discussion of this. You know, so many people do it or say it unintentionally, right? Just as people make all kinds of kind of mental slips. That was sort of the point, right? Was to put this in the title and ask the question, what in fact actually has changed? Well, read the book. Read the book if you want to understand, you know, sort of the essence of real change. That's one point. The second point, you know, a little bit to what Georgi has just said. You know, I was one of those who was, teaching the history of Ukraine and contemporary politics of Ukraine before 2013. And I remember it was often the case that we would ask the question, you know, what has been the achievement of what at that time, of course, was only 20 years of independent Ukraine? You know, what matters about it? And I actually wrote an article to this effect, I want to say around 2011 or 2012, in which the main point was, well, what matters is that Ukraine now has subjecthood, right? That it is the subject of the sentence and not the object. And I think that's very central, but it's also not unidirectional. Because if you think about Ukraine, for example, in the late Soviet era, as a kind of counterpoint to Moscow, right? There was the sort of Moscow narrative, and then, oh, there was what was happening in Soviet Ukraine. There was pressure against the center. There was pressure against the system. And you think of maybe the early 90s as the apotheosis of that. So it ended in the independence of Ukraine and the emergence of this new country. And then you had a period where for a decade or a couple of decades, despite all of the problems, you could say what I said in that article, which is at least Ukraine has been independent. It has had subjecthood. I think one of the challenges today is that increasingly in this dire state of fighting for its survival, fighting for its territorial integrity, fighting, one could say, for its democracy, a lot of the narrative about Ukraine, including from Ukrainians themselves, including from very prominent Ukrainians, has slipped back into the mode of only being a counterpoint to Moscow or being overwhelmingly a counterpoint to Moscow. And I think that's something else that this book pushes back on by saying, yes, of course, there is the narrative of the war. Of course, that's an important narrative. But that's not the history of 30 years, right? There is a story of Ukraine. There are stories of Ukraine which come from Ukrainians as the subject, as opposed to Ukrainians as, you know, either the object or somehow as the opposite of Russia. You know, this is not Kuchma's book. Ukraine is not Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would like also to stress that this book is dedicated to the experience, social experience of a new society. So, and this novelty is interesting, it's intriguing what was happening there. Because when you say Ukraine, it's either war or revolutions, Maidans. Okay, so what else is happening in Ukraine? And why Ukraine is an agency and has an agency? Only because it fights or because there are big political events. And then if you look at this second, third, and the fourth chapter, there you have the history of return of capitalism and how differently it can be described and how differently it can be experienced. So in the second chapter, we have Timofey Milovanov and Ilona Sologub describing how the private sector is appearing. So basically in 1991, we have a huge redivision of all our sphere of conduct into public and private spheres. And public was invented recently and how Ukrainians invented it for themselves. So here comes capitalism, but here comes corruption. Here comes this public-private relationships, and it's important. Or Yulia Yurchenko, Pavlo Kutuyev, Maxim Yenin, and Gennady Korzhov, they were describing how the social inequality appears. So experience of poverty and richness. It's something new. For several generations, it was kind of missing in the culture, and it's back. And what was happening with us? And then energy sector. We now discuss a lot energy, but the long story of it is usually unknown. And here, Margarita Balmaseda and Andrian Prokip provide you with a story, and suddenly you understand how multilateral and complex is all that history. So in a way, the book is, well, it's, I don't want to avoid pompous expressions, but I think in a way it's an encyclopedia of contemporary Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Modest, humble, but with a lot of information. And this is why in the end we asked every author to conduct a list of 10 important further readings, important literature, so that the wider audience or students who study Ukraine in the United States or in the United Kingdom, they could move on already by having certain framework, already understanding the experience of these 30 years, and then go deeper into an issue or another.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You all mentioned revolutions that took place in Ukraine since the 1990s. And to some extent, all of them were similar, and to some extent, all of them were different from each other. Unfortunately, yes, like you pointed out, Ukraine is not only about wars and revolutions, but unfortunately, that's how Ukraine became known to the international communities. And I would like you to share your thoughts on these revolutions in Ukraine, how they different and how they similar.
I would say that, we have a concept, different concepts of revolution, what revolution is. We have a views Stanislav Kruczynski, he wrote a book about a revolution of 1991, saying that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was a revolution and it was also a Ukrainian revolution. We had revolution on granite in 1990. Then there was a invisible revolution of 2000 when there was a split in the parliament and it was called a velvet revolution. Then it was an unfinished revolution of 2001, Kuchma, the movement against Kuchma. And then 2004, which was called revolution, and then 2014, revolution of dignity. So we're very rich of revolutions. The only problem is that we didn't have real revolutions there, probably with some exception, like 91. Yes, it might be considered as a revolution because there was a real shift in all spheres of life. But generally, when Ukraine, when we hear here Ukraine and revolution, it's Orange Revolution and Revolution of Dignity. So, I myself quite skeptical about the term revolution. I prefer to call Orange Revolution electoral protests and Revolution of Dignity a revolt. It is pity. Generally, if we have revolution or we have all this praise for revolution, it means that our citizens do not have any other channels to reach their goals and the goals of democratic society. There is also a concept of peaceful revolution of 2019, the electoral revolution when Zelensky came to power. So that also might be considered as a kind of revolution. So generally, and another final point about revolutions, and this book is exactly about this, picking up what Matt said about that Ukraine versus Russia, not just versus Russia. We have a number of neighbors, we have a broader world, so we should not reduce this to of course we have the problem with Russia now, but generally it's not only Russia which exists in the outer world. And another important aspect of this book in particular is that we have not just Ukraine versus other in terms of other countries, other world, other blocs, other big entities. We also have, according to this book, Ukraine versus Ukraine. We have different Ukraines within Ukraine, and this book is also about this. Either it is chapter on identity or religion or economics or social life or politics, we have Ukraines versus Ukraines. So we have internal strifes, internal contradictions, and a lot of things which should be considered by any student of Ukraine if he or she wants to understand this country adequately.
If I say so on your original question about revolutions, Natalia. So again, as a student of history, I am ceaselessly amazed by how the narrative of revolution it becomes instrumentalized. So because revolution can be a useful word or sometimes a scary word for politics, it becomes a political word. So in actual fact, if you go back to the 19th century, there's as much social and economic, even ethical content to revolution, to the idea of revolution, as there is political, right? So a political regime is in a sense only incidental to the central revolution, right? The central kind of, you can't see my hand gesture, but sort of the turning of the wheel, if you will, of the human experience. And so I think one of the values of this type of narrative, which explicitly puts, or these narratives, which explicitly put, the social and economic experience, the artistic and cultural experience, other dimensions of economic, like energy, et cetera, into the arc of a revolution, if you want to call it that, is that you are not only bound to political change as your device for describing what is revolutionary about Ukraine, or the new Ukraine, if you want to call it that. Because I think one of the things that's revolutionary is the relationship between money, power, instruments of the state, et cetera, in modern Ukraine. I think Ukraine has established a very significant paradigm for how those things work. People use the O word, oligarch, as a kind of shorthand for that. That's revolutionary, right? I mean, that doesn't mean that it's never happened in human history, but it's not the way things were 30 years ago. And it may not be the way things are 30 years from now. So again, I would say that that is not necessarily first political in its character. It's economic, it's social, it's kind of all encompassing. And when you see the Pinchuk Art Center in the very middle of Kiev, well, it's also about art and culture, isn't it?
Well, and I would like to say that from a philosophical point of view, revolution is the time and space of new beginnings, of new unprecedented beginnings. And of course, from that point of view, 1991 is the revolutionary moment for Ukraine, and Ukraine is itself a product of that revolution. But then, and Matt and I describe it in our chapter, Ukraine has gone through two full revolutionary cycles, from the promise of freedom in politics, also in economy, and then to the momentum of disorientation, authoritarian attempts, and then new revolt, new change of government, change of regime, and another one. So between 91 and 2004, between 2005 and 2013, there were two full cycles. And the mystery and the question remains if the third cycle is in place. Have Ukraine broken this non-evolutionary development, cyclic development, or not? Did the war factor actually played this important role in changing the pattern of development? It's still not clear up until today. There's a debate among philosophers, historians, and sociologists on this, but we raise this issue. So two cycles are in the past. Are we evolving, or are we just reaching out for the new revolutionary moment? And then I would like to pick up to what Georgi said about absence of revolutionary change. Usually, a revolutionary event is divided into three factors or three niveaus. The first one is the event itself, so protests, clashes, change of government. But the second part is the revolutionary outcome. What have changed? Did the political system or economic or social system change or not? And the third one is the revolutionary myth. And with the change, we always have problem. After 2004, system seems to remain unchanged. Oligarchic system remained after 2014. However, the myth was created in the both cases in 2004-05. You remember there was even Museum of Orange Revolution, there was Order of Orange Revolution. And then there's a myth of Euromaidan, or Revolution of Dignity. So in a way, we have different elements of revolution in place, except for the revolutionary change, at least recently.
I have two follow-up questions. One of them will be about Russia and the current relations between Ukraine and Russia. And another one will be on the memory politics in Ukraine today. But I will start with the question about the Ukrainian-Russian relations today. When I talk to people about the events, there is always this issue about terminology. How we describe the current situation? At some point, we were using words like or terms like conflict. Some are quite dissatisfied with this term and they change it into aggression. In terms of Crimea, at the beginning, it looked like we unanimously accepted the term annexation, but recently annexation changed into occupation of Crimea as well as in Donbas. So I'm wondering if you could briefly describe how you positioned your volume in terms of the current Ukrainian-Russian relations.
I mean, I can just jump in and say that there are some of this is a technical question, right? You know, you go with a publisher and a publisher has a whole style guide and you have to kind of defer to the publisher's style guide. Similarly, the Woodrow Wilson Center is a U.S. government, congressionally chartered federal institution. So for the most part, I think that those are good things. I think that the way that they treat kind of controversial nuances of language is pretty consistent and is pretty good. To the extent that there's an editorial bias, at least on my part, I think it's always in favor of, you know, deferring to what the sort of official preference of the country in question is. So if, you know, the Ukrainian state says, this is how we spell Kyiv, right? You know, it's not K-I-E-V, it's K-Y-I-V. Then the answer is that's how you spell Kyiv, right? It's fairly simple. It is, of course, true that there are publications out there that, you know, nonetheless produce perfectly good scholarship or journalistic content that refuse to follow those rules, that have their own ideas. But as a general rule, I would argue against kind of paying overly much attention to these superficial things. And that's what I meant about the cheekiness of the title, right? I know I myself just committed this fallacy earlier in the conversation by referring to Kuchma's book as, you know, Russia is not, Ukraine is not Russia, but solely by the title, right? As if to symbolize everything with the title. But actually, the point of our title was to say that there's so much more than the appearance or disappearance of an article. So again, I think the style guide and editorial is fairly good. I feel good about where we are with this volume, but it is not intended in and of itself to be kind of in place of content.
Well, we have very different positions and different perceptions and different interpretations of how to present it. It depends on authors. We have a lot of authors, and they might have their own perception and way of presentation. We also can say that there is official position of Ukraine about Donbas, about Crimea, that it's occupied territory. So if to follow official speech, official discourse, we can say, yes, it's a occupation. If we speak about process and results, yes, it's annexation. So I would join the point of view that it depends on the way of presentation of this. In Ukraine, it is quite sensitive topic now because we have these internal divisions, not just social or regional, also political. And we also have a kind of censorship when, for instance, if you use the concept of civil war, speaking about Donbas, it's very much unwelcomed. And if you would recognize that there are features of civil conflict there, if you would say that there are people with Ukrainian citizenship who fight against you, people with Ukrainian citizenship, and would say that it is civic conflict or civil war, then you might be ostracized. So people can do this in academic discussions, but when you speak publicly, then it becomes very sensitive. And another point here, of course, when you speak about Ukrainian-Russian relations, then we have this kind of common approach that Russia considered as a kind of single actor with no differences within Russia. But when we talk, when we discuss Russian politics, there are a lot of people there in Russia who do not accept neither occupation or annexation. Those people who do not support Putin, those people who are in open or in hidden opposition, etc. So it is very important to understand when we write about something about Ukraine, first of all, about multiplicity of different choices within Ukraine and about multiplicities of different concepts regarding the neighbors, including, of course, Russia.
Well, and in addition, in most of the chapters, you can see how the conflict, the war, the loss of control over the territories due to aggression and occupation and annexation, how it's been perceived and how it became part of Ukrainian social experience. So that was the major issue for us. For example, in a chapter on Ukrainian contemporary art, authors show how it's how it became an event that inspires a lot of artists today. That's the experience that should be expressed, in, or how it makes an impact on the religious sphere. How three Romes now became they have their own representation, one Kiev. So all these aspects. Not political, but rather experience of contemporary nation is there. And that's very important because these games with the language, they also are very toxic in a way because they try to control how you think, how you speak, and put in some paranoia. But while you work with experience and with social experience, you bring some therapy. And this book is part of this overarching process of therapy.
I have this second question about the memory politics. And Georgi, you earlier mentioned that we should also pay attention to the fact that there are different Ukraines in Ukraine. And on the one hand, I also believe that we should probably carefully spelled out what we mean by different Ukraines in Ukraine. On the other hand, it's some sort of a tradition, political and cultural and historical tradition in Ukraine when we talk about either different regional peculiarities or political peculiarities and so on and so forth. But my question is about the current memory politics and to what extent it is accommodating towards this idea of different Ukraines in Ukraine.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that well, once again, we can say when we discuss the memory politics, we again can discuss the Ukraine versus Ukraine, or Ukraine's versus Ukraine's. I once in the past, I even had an idea to write a book. Under the title History of Ukraines in plural. And this is really challenging, particularly in the light of recent developments in the world. You see that it's tendency everywhere now to use, misuse and abuse the memory issues and to introduce them into very different fields of politics. Including U.S., where so I was sure that it is not the issue for Americans, and it was then so much heavily instrumentalized in the last 5 years. Ukraine, it is particularly keen issue, and we have a yes, you have mentioned that we have different historical traditions, different legacies. And these different legacies are still alive, first of all. And second, it is very important that these legacies are cherished or cultivated by different political actors. And they get symbolical capital, and they also get not very much symbolical, very material capitals when having exploiting this issue. So it is really hot. Well, yesterday we had a certain date. And once again, as always on 9th of May, some small scandals, some different different approaches, some different versions of the past. And of course, it is also the neighbors really heavily involved into this. Russia first, then Poland. We also have real controversies with Poland, while our other neighbors also have controversies between them. So it is a really hot issue, and it probably deserves a separate volume sometimes in the future. But generally, yes, we didn't pay this special attention to this issue in the volume. It should be there, of course. It is somehow reflected in the identity chapter, but generally, that's probably a small gap in the book, but probably we will do something in the future.
I would like to add here that we still have different stories and different memories, but not in terms of regional memories, but in terms of social groups' memories, class memories. If you look, for example, two chapters, one chapter is written about privatization from neoliberal perspective, and the another one about social history from social democratic perspective. And then you see very, very much differently how the same events or same decisions, same laws are described from different points of view. And for the class of private owners or private entrepreneurs, there are very bright events in the past of Ukraine. However, the working class or the rural population may remember same events or same laws as a disaster, as something that kind of diminished their freedoms, their income, and so on. So in a way, if we indeed do not discuss the memory issues here, but we have this presence of different memories in different groups. Also for the contemporary art. So there are three periods, and each of them described in a different way, with different distance. So here you see somewhere there's a crystallized memory, memory in process of being crystallized, it's something very fresh, this art during the war, after the revolution. So it's something even described recently. So here you can see the laboratory of memory, how it's being coined.
If I can, Natalia, if I have a moment, I just want to really recommend the Mikheyeva and Shevel chapter on identity, because I think it's a fantastic chapter. I mean, Georg is right. We could do much more. We could do a whole volume. But there's a line here that I think is a wonderful example of kind of multiple narratives and dialogue. The process of transition from peace to war, starting in 2014, pushed the average person to rethink their national identity, to build new distances and criteria for distinguishing between themselves and the others, us and them, and to reset the boundaries and conditions of interaction. The point of this line is that almost every narrative about identity starts from the premise that you have identity, and then you have conflict because you have warring identities. And this flips it on its head. It says you have conflict, you have war, or you have a process of going from peace to war. And this is creating identity. And there's a very deep insight in that. So I just want to recommend the chapter if you're interested in those questions.
Just one more question concerning identity and concerning history of Ukraine as well. Very often, this description of Ukraine comes up in academic publications, contested. Would you agree that this is the accurate way to describe Ukraine as a political entity, as a historical entity, that there are a lot of contestations with which we have to deal with? Because on the other hand, there is a suggestion to look at these contestations in terms of multi-directionality, and I think that it somehow resonates with the approach of your book where you suggest multiple views on issues.
Well, I would say that there is some resonance in all the chapters. So all nine chapters resonate with each other. There are some events like the beginning of independence, Orange Revolution, Euromaidan, they are there and they are important landmarks. However, yes, it's definitely a very diverse society. Well, Ukraine is diverse. But it's also the historiography, the way we approach Ukraine is very diverse. If you look 30 years ago, what was Ukraine as a subject of study? Literature, language, and history. And then if you look today, it's so many different subjects. In energy security, in military history, in diplomacy, in political science, in sociology, in value studies. So suddenly you see Ukraine everywhere as important part of contemporary global landscape. So this is where this article, definite article the, was dropped. And this is, I think, the best result of both Ukraine's development and Ukrainian studies development.
Yeah, I might just quickly add to what Misha said that, I'm generally not a fan of the academic or the kind of the volume of scholarly data that has been suddenly produced in the wake of the war that started in 2014, because I think a lot of it is, not of great quality, right? It's kind of outcome oriented rather than, driven by longstanding knowledge and expertise. But that said, you increasingly see data from Ukraine in global data sets. I mean, that has been a big change in the last decade. And for those of us who have always been paying attention to Ukraine, this is really satisfying. This is a good thing. But I think it will take longer. I think it will take probably another decade before we begin to see the normalization of Ukraine as one of the large European sort of case studies for a number of different academic disciplines.
My final question will be about, I think you already touched upon this a little bit, most important achievement of Ukraine since it gained independence. Just maybe a sentence or just a word.
Well, I would say that for me, the status of agency, that was something very, very important. 30 years is, there's a adolescent time in the past, there's youth in the past, and it's the beginning of maturity. And here the mature post-Soviet nation in a very difficult region in times of growing divisions, and here Ukraine needs maturity and wisdom, and I think what we show in the book, it's becoming that.
Yes, I think that we answered this question several times already in other interviews. So yes, Ukraine exists as a agency. It exists for 30 years. It's unprecedented fact that Ukraine exists for so long time. It's a very short time in fact, but generally there were no other cases in history when Ukraine existed for 30 years. And since it's a very different world, Ukraine exists in the changing world, and Ukraine also changes. And it is interesting when we live here and we accustomed to what is going on here, we're tired of everything, of corruption, of instability, of a lot of things. But generally, if you observe it from some kind of a distance, you can see that there is a lot of great changes in this country, and it is also a kind of result. Again, one of these results is that Ukraine is the part of the world as a agency, and it is a part of greater world. It's included in this graded world. It is not isolated as it was during the Soviet times.
I am obviously biased. We wrote the chapter on democracy, but I think it's democracy. And democracy enables things we have seen that we could not have imagined, good things. But also, of course, it is vulnerable to some of the bad things that we see in the United States as well. It's harder to solve certain problems when you're subject to the forces of democratic politics, right? You can't just decide by will and enforce by power. You're more subject to disinformation. This has been, I would say, the curse of Ukraine's democracy for a long time. And of course, as Georgi points out, when you have democracy, you have the chance for people to become indifferent or dissatisfied or angry. And that can be as much a negative force as a positive force. Sometimes it can bring change. But for sure, to me, it's democracy. And 30 years basically of democracy is an incredibly important story.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation today. And again, congratulations on this wonderful volume that offers a multi-layered vision on the history of Ukraine. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Natalia.
Today I spoke with Mikhailo Minakov, Georgi Kasyanov, and Matt Rochansky about the edited volume From the Ukraine to Ukraine, A Contemporary History, 1991-2021, published by Ibidem Verlag Stuttgart in 2021. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.